As someone pursuing early financial independence, it's almost guaranteed that over time, a lot of your wealth will come from investment growth. But as we know, it takes money to make money. The first $100,000 of your net worth is going to be a lot of hard work. You need to make income, live below your means, and aggressively save. And through all of this, your career will be the backbone of this process. Improving the skills that make you more valuable is an important journey throughout your 20s. If you put effort in the right places, you will become a high performer and be paid accordingly. So with that in mind, what should we be focusing on? There are technical skills that will be in high demand in the future. Think AI, cybersecurity, logistics, but these are industry specific. There are also a set of skills that no matter what career path you pursue, will always pay dividends. Today, we're going to be talking about the latter with Dave Lamont. Dave knows a thing or two about this subject as he's built an incredible career for himself and not slowing down anytime soon. Dave is the CEO of Renfrew Business Group and the president of Renfrew Chrysler, Lloydminster Nissan, and Royalty RV. In this episode, Dave shares six essential skills that led him to success with the hope that you'll find career success as well, no matter how you define that. So if that sounds up your alley, let's get into it. I hope you enjoy my conversation with the former hockey player, car enthusiast, and author of Crank It, Dave Lamont. You know those moments where you think, I wish I would have learned this in school? Those are the topics that we love to talk about. Join me each week as I interview experts sharing their strategies for solving problems that us young adults will face throughout our 20s and 30s. So what are you waiting for? If you want new episodes about adulting advice every Monday, hit that follow button. Well, Dave, I'm excited to have you on the podcast today. You wrote a book called Crank It, subtitled A Playbook for Succeeding in Business and Life. And the book shares a lot of resources and plans and honestly just inspiration for creating opportunities for yourself and bulletproofing your career. And when I speak to a lot of young adults, I feel like that is one of the best things they can do whenever they're thinking about their finances is really create a great bedrock around your career skills, essential career skills, so that you're always employable and that you're always looked at as a top performer. And that was my idea for today's conversation. You had a ton of different skills and a lot of different tactical pieces of advice and stories. And I want to piece them together and really talk through, I think, six essential skills to have a successful career. And like I said, I'm going to make you kind of pull through a couple of stories throughout your, I don't know, is it three, maybe almost four decades worth of career at this point in time?
Three decades, just coming up 30 years.
So let's start with number one, which I feel like is the best place to start, especially with you, because I feel like this is just such a easy yet hard skill to master. It's not something that I think needs a lot of tactical advice around it, but number one for me is hard work. And I could tell you learned hard work at an early age. I'd love it if you could share a memory going into work with your dad on a Saturday and kind of how that set you up or set the stage for what hard work really meant to you.
You know, looking back, I was, you know, really young. I'm guessing, you know, 10, 11, 12, and my father always worked 6 hours a day or 6 days a week, and that was just normal in the Lamont family. So my father and I were very close, so he would take me in on Saturdays. And he would work Saturdays and I'd be, you know, in the back warehouse. He'd hand me a broom and say, start sweeping, start cleaning. And it just became normal to me. And, he was a very successful person. And I think a key to his success was hard work. So I learned it through him that hard work creates opportunities. And, you know, to reiterate, I was probably, you know, 10, 11, 12, very, very young person. And, you know, I'm going to driving with him on a Saturday. You know, most people are probably still in bed and we'd be driving to his office at, you know, 9 or 9:30, 10 in the morning on a Saturday. So that's just, and to this day, for the last 29 years, since I started my career, I still work Saturdays to this day and I will continue till the end. That's just how I was raised. I, you know, was proud to say my father instilled that in my brother and I, hard work.
That's really cool. And I like in the final chapter when you were talking about being someone that someone wants to follow. Like you mentioned, like, I would never ask my employees to come in on a Saturday if I was hitting the golf course or hitting the beach on that Saturday too. Not only are you in on the Saturday, but you're also probably in an hour before everybody else gets in on that Saturday afternoon too.
You know, absolutely. And I don't think it's right to, you know, have one of my managers say, you know, be here Saturday morning at 8 a.m. for a kickoff meeting if I'm not here at 7:30 to help with the kickoff meeting. If I'm on the golf course all day, I don't believe that's leadership skills. It's not instilling in what I want from them. If I can't do it myself, it's not right to ask them to do it. I don't think that's a good leader nor a good owner. And right or wrong, that's my opinion. I think it's so important to lead by example. People want to learn through osmosis and see how the leader does it. And I've just old school that way, that if I ask someone to work 10 hours a day, it's because I work 11. And when I ask people to work the hours or the days they do, I don't have any complaints because I'm doing it with them.
Yeah, that's fair. Along with your dad, it seemed like there was another person that really helped instill hard work and drive. And that was a person by the name of Mike Tarp. Can you tell me a little bit about Mike, his kind of immigrant story, and actually who he ended up being at kind of the crest of your guys' relationship?
I would love to tell you the story, actually. I'm very proud of him. Mike Tarp, who owned Renfrew Chrysler, which I purchased from him in 2008. He came from Denmark in 1965. He always tells a story with 80 cents in his pocket. And ended up in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And he started cutting carpet, and he wanted to get into sales in the car business. And it's such a great story. I love it. And he would say, Davey, he always called me Davey, he'd say, Davey, I was knocking on dealerships' doors to sell cars, and they said my English was so poor that I'm trying my best to learn English. He goes, I watch a lot of cartoons because the animation helped me learn English. I said, really? He said, yeah, cartoons is a very good way to learn it. And I said, well, I never knew that. But he said cartoons, the animation helped him. So he kept knocking on doors, a man of true grit, Tarpy. He said, finally, he kept nagging this one dealership. Finally, he said, if you quit nagging, we'll give you a chance selling cars. And he goes, absolutely. When can I start? They said, as soon as you like. He goes, can I start this afternoon? Certainly. So lo and behold, Mike, in the first month, sells the most cars at the dealership for any of the salespeople. Fast forward from there, in 6 months, he's a sales manager. 3 months after that, he's a general sales manager. And then he has an opportunity to buy into a dealership in 1985 in Calgary, which is Renfrew Chrysler. And Chrysler Corporation placed him here. And again, he always say, Davey, this immigrant, you know, coming from nothing, look what I can do. And goes on to make Renfrew Chrysler the number one dealership in Canada. And all by hard work. You know, he didn't let anything stop him. You know, his lack of education, his challenge being an immigrant, not knowing English. It was kind of a motivation. You know, for young people, it's a nice story to hear. Like, with all the things that were stacked against him, he used it as a motivation. It wasn't a problem. It was an opportunity or a challenge. And the story to this day, I honestly will tell Mike Tarp's story once a quarter to young people I meet, and you know, the pride I have for him is unreal. He passed away sadly, but you know, he had a great, great life, a good run. And he, you know, when you see those stories, it tells you opportunities that everyone has. You can make the most of it. You know, his lack of things he made up for with hard work, grit, perseverance, wanting to win, wanting to be the best.
Do you feel like that? Knowing Mike and a little bit of his style and skill set, do you feel like that the hard work, the grit, was really what led him to selling the most cars that first month? Or was there something else tactical that he was really good at that made him a top salesperson?
Well, I think a lot of it is, you know, I would read it this way as, you know, when your second language is English, your emotional intelligence seems to become higher because you read body language so well, because you don't understand English that well. So your emotional intelligence of watching people, you're reading them so well by their body language that I think that would have helped him sell the most cars. Of course, his hard work and grit, working 12, 13 hour days, you know, you'd have such an opportunity above the rest who are working 6 and 7 hours a day. But I really think a second language could have been a benefit to him, because he read people like unbelievable, how he could read people by their body language. And I think he, at the time, may not have known it, but I look back at it and I think that would have been a benefit, the way he could read people and read a room so well.
Yeah, I feel like that's probably something we're probably going to get into at a later skill here, my number three skill. But number two is time management. And I feel like this is what separates a lot of the good employees from the great employees. Because it's interesting, everybody has the same amount of time in a day. And it's really interesting to see people that are really good at managing this finite resource. And they just get leaps and bounds ahead of other people because of this. Like, if you can get done in one day what someone can get done in 3 days, like, you're just 3x faster at your acceleration with inside of your career and your progress and things like that. You personally, you have this, you talked about this concept called the pad. Can you tell me a little bit about what the pad is and how you use that around time management?
Yeah, the pad is a thing I've been using for all of 20 years, and it's a white pad of paper and a pen. I'm old school. And so I have my pad of my daily things I have to do, the tactical things that have to be done in a shorter term period. So I'll write down what I have to do for the day, what needs to be done, and I check off the things that I get done for the day. I date it, and the things I don't get done, I transfer the next page, and I put the page into a binder from that day, and then started the next page of what didn't get completed, and then what needs to be done the next day, if that's making sense. But if it's not done that day, it goes to the next day, and until it's done and handled, it stays on that pad. And the staff here always say to me, put it on the pad, I know it'll get done. and it's at that point, literally, Justin, that staff will say, make sure, Lamont, get it on your pad, I know it will get done. And it does. And I laugh because the system's old school, but I absolutely love it because it works. And why would I change it and get more technical with it? For the younger viewers on this, there's probably new technology to use than the pad with your computer or your iPhone. But the pad it's absolutely dynamite for me. I love it because it works like a charm. And it sounds so simple, but if you follow it, it becomes time management 101.
I think that's so fair. And I think many people in the productivity space overcomplicate a to-do list. And even if you want to digitize, and I think you do digitize your to-do list to an extent. I think I remember you writing in the book that you'll move some to-do items to your phone so that you always have it handy there. But I'm also guessing you're probably someone that just has the pad in his pocket at all point in times too.
I have the clipboard. I carry the clipboard around with the pad on it.
But yeah, I do something very similar. I just have a note in my phone, in the notes app on my iPhone, and I have my to-do list. And it might have a little bit more complexity than just it gets written down and it gets crossed off on the to-do list. But I think at least figuring out a system that works for you to document things that need to be done and then hold yourself accountable to make sure this to-do list isn't just becoming an ever-growing repository of things you wish you did, but actually a place where you are making progress on and crossing things off. And I would love to explore that a little bit more with you, because it's one thing to have an organized system for collecting the things that need to get done, but what about actually getting the things done? Do you have any philosophies or strategies to make sure that you can get all of the things done in one day?
Well, I think I almost, You know, I start with the hot items. Like I'm an early guy, I get into work early. You know, I get most of my days done by 10 a.m. You know, from 6 to 10, I'll get the hot items done. And I work on the things I need to get done that are urgent items. You know, there's the hot items, the medium items, the not as important items. So I'll work through what needs to be done that is imperative to be done early. And I'll work through it that way. And then before I leave at the end of the day, anything that needed to be done that day, I refuse to leave until it's done. Or I will never leave anything in my inbox. I will not leave work until it's all replied to or handled in some manner. And I think that's a good system for me, that at the end of the day, I will look in my email inbox and nothing is going unturned or untouched. And that's something very important for the younger listeners. If there's something in your inbox, and it used to be a paper inbox, today it's our email, it won't go away. So deal with that email. At least get a response to it. Say, received, thank you. I will have a formal response to this email within 48 hours. And if you say 40 hours, make sure they get 48 hours. Make sure they get it back in 32 hours. So you're ahead of the game there.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I always like the under-promise and over-deliver methodology with clients, with colleagues, with kind of anything in life. And I think that really sets you up for success. Also, another thing that sets you up for success is the capability of building rapport, which is my third skill, essential skill. And this one, I feel like, is a little bit more tactical. I don't think everyone comes from a really charismatic background like your dad and the skill set that he kind of passed along to you, maybe through osmosis. But I think you just honestly having a role model in your life and seeing some of the things that he does, it translated pretty well to you. But you do mention that in the book, I have a quote here that says, how to work with anyone is a valuable and learnable skill. So it's less about just like always being able to charm someone, but also being able to work with multiple people and to build a relationship fast with someone. So I would love to talk a little bit more about that and maybe actually bring it back to your dad, because I found it really cool that your dad at an early age invited you and your brother Doug to join him at the dinner table whenever he had business friends in town. Can you share a memory or two from that experience and how that might have set you up for being able to build rapport and relationships with people?
Absolutely. And I do want to lead into that with, I did have a marked advantage as well with my mother being a social worker. She understood how to read people, how to build rapport and understand different, you know, wherever she was, she understood the room and the people. So that definitely was a valued asset with my mother, Pat Lamont. And then leading with that is my father at the time, Doug and I didn't know, but you know, we were young guys. I would have been maybe 10, Doug would have been 13, and he'd have business association from Chicago, Toronto, you know, different Canadian, United States cities. And we'd be in the dining room table and we'd have a dinner with these business associates. And I think, you know, a lot in that situation, you know, a lot of fathers in that situation, you know, hey, boys, go to bed. He'd say, no, stay up another hour. And I remember being absolutely enthralled. And maybe that gave me that business sense. My brother and I'd sit there and listen to these stories. And I think to be involved with it at such a young age, it gave you a business mindset. And I became such a sponge, as my brother called me the other day. Ironically, he goes, Dave, you're a sponge. And I said, well, I think our father was teaching us to be a sponge. And I certainly became a sponge and watching mannerisms and how we reacted with different people, how their conversations were different. You know, some might have been a sports lover, a baseball lover, hockey, basketball, football, and he would work whatever their topic they liked. There'd be some business banter back and forth. And I look back and I just smile and think what a cool experience that I had to, you know, it wasn't formal. That's what made it so fantastic, Justin, just being part of that and seeing a role model like that. And so seeing the business aspect and a mother that was a social worker, it was, I couldn't have had a better grounding with their different backgrounds. So I'm very grateful of that. But those dinner tables, and it seems like it was yesterday. And I mean, it's, you know, 40 years ago, and it literally seems like it was yesterday. So these stories, I can remember sitting, which chair I sat at the dining room table, and where my brother would sit, whoever was in our business, which chair they would sit in. Invaluable, absolutely invaluable in life.
Yeah. And then 10 years later, you're 23 years old.
Yes.
And you start working at Chrysler and their corporate team. And I'm guessing that you were probably working with people twice your age, you know, maybe in their 50s and 60s. And I think a lot of 20 somethings get set in these kind of situations, especially if you're in older industries like financial services or blue collar work or things like that. And if you haven't interacted with people that are twice your age that time, sometimes it can be hard to break conversation and to build rapport, because maybe you haven't had kids and you don't have that rapport, or maybe you don't follow the local or regional news and you can't lean or crutch on that. Are, you know, thinking back to you as a 20-something and how you built rapport with people that were twice your age in the workplace, any tips or strategies you can share?
Yeah, and you know, it's a very good question, Justin. As you know, when I started, I was 23, a young person, but I had those skills as a young person, you know, how my father would dress, how these people coming in our business would dress. So, you know, I would go at 23, I'm, you know, wearing a nice suit, interacting with people 48, 50, 60, a lot older than me, but I was very comfortable because I was used to people dealing with at that age. And a lot of my friends to this day are, you know, 20 years older than me. A lot of my good friends are, because I dealt with a lot of older people when I was younger. And, you know, I'd look for common ground. My first boss at the time, fantastic guy, he was 25 years older, so he was 48. And, you know, I would watch what he did outside of work and listen to what he did. And, you know, and there was a local pub he would go to after. So I learned that, and he would play the VLTs, video lottery terminals. So I knew a little bit about them from university. So I said, hey, I like playing VLTs, do you? He said, well, of course I do. Why don't you come over and play with me? So I walked myself into the situation. You know, to my advantage, I knew that I was getting the invite without him knowing I was going to get an invite, if that makes sense. But I made myself part of the team by building that rapport, knowing what he liked to do. So lo and behold, he invited me over, and it started a relationship that carried on for so many years, even after I left the corporation and went to retail. And it was as simple as building a little bit of common ground that made us hit it off so well right out of within the first week, literally. And I can only say great things about him. And it was that little trigger point, because I knew he played VLTs at the local pub, and lo and behold, you know, we're over there. And then I started asking, gave me an opportunity to ask him questions, why he started with Chrysler Corporation, what was his background, where did he come from, what sports he liked. And it opened the door for so many more questions, because now we're out of the work environment. We're in a more comfort environment and chatting about life. Then he was asking me about University of Montana, and it built a beautiful relationship. So the 25 years age difference, that would tell everyone listening to this or watching this, age literally is just a number. It's irrelevant. As I say, a lot of my great friends are 25 years older, and a lot of my great friends are 20 years younger now. So it's all about building reports, and it's not about anyone's, you know, age. You know, it's really about building rapport and finding common ground.
And that's the beauty. I mean, I've learned this through podcasting. I've definitely learned it throughout my career because I started at a financial services insurance brokerage at 19. And not only were people twice my age, but sometimes three times my age.
Right.
And it took me a while, but I did find out that you kind of have common ground with everybody, even people in their 60s. We would be having conversations about playing collegiate sports, and they were a college athlete 40 years ago, and they loved hearing some of the stories of what was happening whenever I was in college and playing sports. And I would love to hear them share their stories, and we would talk about the differences between collegiate sports when they played and when they didn't play. I think at the end of the day, it really just comes down to quality questions and curiosity. And if you can be curious and keep prying and digging and asking good follow-up questions, you might not only find common ground, but you might create common ground. Like maybe you guys both love media, and it may be media from different decades, but you might start sharing about some of the things that you love about the media of your decade, and they might start sharing about the media from their decade. And then you might be swapping recommendations, and they go watch a film, you know, from the 2000s, you go watch a film from the 70s, and then you can come back together and you can really have this like amazing shared built relationship over time because you invested in them and they invested in you.
No, absolutely. I agree 100%, Justin.
Let's talk about number four, which is always be learning. I think this is such a critical skill.
Yeah.
I want to say, especially in your 20s, but I'm guessing it. This is a critical skill throughout your entire lifetime. And I love this quote that I pulled from your book, which you said, you'd rather make a slow quarter over a quick dime. And if I'm getting that right, it's like you would rather like be invested and learn something and share the value, a higher value thing, than just kind of turn over and quickly make some money on there. But I was really surprised and kind of actually a little delighted when I heard that you took a course on social media. It seemed like it was a big blind spot for you, and you wanted to get a little bit more attuned and equipped in the area of social media. So why did you initially decide to take that course, and then what did you ultimately learn from it?
You know, why I decided is I have a social media manager here, Justine, who's absolutely fantastic, but I wanted to be on the same page with her. I didn't want to do her job. She's so good at it, but I wanted to be on the same page and be able to work through it with her. So knowledge is power, as we all know. So I said, well, let's find a social media course and get me up to speed. And so we found the social media course, and, you know, it was the best thing I did, you know, and I was certainly the oldest in the class, but again, age is just a number. I'm the oldest guy in the class or oldest person. And that's why it was so, the investment, it could have been any amount, Justin. Take that away. The amount did not matter. What I gathered from a day of a course, so now I can speak to social media, you know, with the dealership, with Justine. And our social media since that course has gone nothing but uphill. It's just we're all better on the same page. And it was literally, it was a day course, and it was 8 in the morning till 4. It was the best 8 hours I spent for social media. And that tells you anything you want to find today is findable. And anytime I can read a book, take a course, you know, since I took that initial one, we've taken a few more social media marketing courses. That's for any age, but people in their 20s, any chance you get to learn something, don't pass it up. And if you listen to that today, you'll thank yourself in 10 or 15 years from now, because you'll continue the learning process. And I will continue learning, because you can always get better at what you do. I think there's so many more opportunities. And I think if you get on that learning now, you'll continue to do the learning, and you have such a marked advantage. People get comfortable as they get older.
Yeah.
And my competition, I don't really worry about all that much, because as they're getting comfortable, I feel like I'm 23 years old again, just an older version with 30 years of experience. that, but I'm continuing. I'm 23 or 30 years experience. That's maybe Dave Lamont. And I'm continuing to learn. I absolutely love it. As you can see, the passion I have for learning, I love it because it's there. You don't have to get a four-year degree. If you can, it's fantastic, but you don't have to. There's so many good things out there. Courses on writing, public speaking, all those important finance courses. There's just so many good things out there that will give you a marked advantage over your competition and make yourself better. Because at the end of the day, you're really only competing with yourself, but you can make yourself better every month, every week, every day.
I would love to zoom you back to when you were in your 20s and you were going and you were thinking about investing into different educational opportunities. And at that point in time, when money is tight, you second guess some of these things, like going to buy a $500 course to you right now and this part of your journey might make a lot of sense and that might be an easy decision for you. But whenever you're making, you know, $32,000 and you're really struggling to kind of get by, any thoughts on getting comfortable spending money on education and investing in yourself?
I think, you know, and it's, again, it's easy for me to say it, but I think if I could had a time machine to go back in my 20s, I did spend money. Even in my 30s, I spent money that it was a bit of a struggle to get. I did a NADA course, National Automobile Dealers Association course. It was in McLean, Virginia, and it was a lot of money at the time, but it was so valuable. So anyone, you know, listening to this or watching it, you know, set aside some money to take some courses, because now we're back to the, it's a slow quarter over a quick dime. The money you spend today comes back literally. The course I took at NADA, all said and done, I think it was around $40,000. Well, since I took the course 20 years ago, what's my return on investment? It would boggle your mind what that investment was. So, and that's a true story from Dave Lamont. I couldn't spend the money fast enough, and it's a true story. I'm not telling you something to do that I haven't done. I took the time, spent the money. I had to travel across the country. It took a day of travel. I'd leave Sunday at 7 in the morning, get in at 10 at night. Course Monday to Friday, fly back, get it home Friday at midnight, back to work Saturday. I had to do that 6 weeks over a year. And it was such a good investment. So to people on the call at any age, don't look at it as an expense. It's an investment. It will pay just tenfold. And even if you get one thing out of a day course or a week course or two or three things, it usually will pay the course five times back over. So that's really good advice for anyone on this. You know, take the money out of the equation. Look at what the long-term benefits are, the opportunity cost that is there for you.
Yeah. And it's, of course, we live in a day and age now where there's so many free resources, tons of podcasts, YouTube, blogs, a lot out there that you can learn and absorb. So if money is tight, but you still want to invest in yourself, you can probably go get or find some of that unstructured learning. But there is moments and times where I think it's probably appropriate to consider some kind of structured education through a paid program or a course or a convention or a conference. And setting aside a little bit of your money, if it's a percentage of your income or a percentage of your you know, kind of take home or discretionary pay, I think is a really great idea, and almost forcing yourself to do it. And for the budgeting people out there, I put a line item. It's one of the few line items that I actually force myself to hit that budget amount every single year. It's like I set this amount for training and development and learning opportunities. And I'm excited whenever I overspend on that. That's because I found too many opportunities this year that I felt like were really worth the investment into. And that's one thing I really don't hold back on. And I don't mind pulling out of another category if it's entertainment or eating out or something like that in order to beef up that line item.
Absolutely. Now that's money well spent, taking it from something that's not a necessity by any means, but it's putting into something that is building your future at any age.
Number five is confidence. And I don't know, maybe this one is, I think, a little debatable in terms of an essential skill. But I do see the people, there's like a hard line, this kind of confident group of people and this unconfident group of people. And the acceleration that I see really confident people have is incredible. And I think there needs to be a little bravado. And we'll definitely get to whenever you cross the line and confidence really turns into cockiness and how to keep those differentiated. But I think it's important in an early age to be confident. And we've talked about this before on the show too. A lot of confidence comes internally and it's being sold on yourself. And it's making sure that you feel really confident so that that externally comes out. What in your eyes, where do you think confidence comes from? And how did you start to gain confidence in your 20s?
Well, I think one thing I wake up and ask myself, what am I selling today? Well, I'm selling Dave Lamont. So that's the first thing is I want to wake up, even in my 20s, I would have my list, what I want to go through in the morning, which I worked on the night before. This is how I want to plan my day. I'm clean shaven. I'm dressed very well. My shoes are shined. And that would create confidence for me. I mean, things have changed since, you know, I was in my 20s. Like, it was heavy suit and ties, shine shoes. I want to look my best. You know, I want to be well-written, I think creates confidence. Well-spoken creates confidence. You know, when I meet someone, I want to shake their hand and look them in the eyes. Hi, very nice, a pleasure to meet you. I'm Dave Lamont. It's just how you feel about yourself and how you judge other people. Not judge, wrong word, how you think of other people. And I treat people very well. And 99% of the time, it's reciprocal. And the 1% it's not reciprocal, well, I probably don't need them around. And that would give me the confidence of, you know, building rapport too, I think creates confidence. And again, the daily checklist of what I want to do for that day about Dave Lamont would give me that confidence. You know, knowing I'd be the first at work in the morning, that will give you confidence. Knowing I work hard would give me confidence. Knowing I'm working harder than someone would give Dave Lamont confidence. May not everyone else, but those are some of the things that work for me. Being the most organized person in the room would give me confidence. Going into a boardroom, having to do a presentation, that would give me confidence. The call today, I have 2 pages of notes I worked on yesterday. Have I used them? No, but it gives me confidence to have them, knowing that I've done the notes. So I think preparation gives you confidence, how you carry yourself, how you dress.
Yeah, I really, really agree with that thought. There is nothing, whenever I feel my most confident is whenever I am most prepared for the situation at hand, and then vice versa. There are times that I feel very unconfident, and that's because I feel like I got thrust into something and didn't have the opportunity to plan and get organized around something like that. And I'd be curious to know what the, you know, what you thinking about listening to this right now thinks about the suit and tie approach or just the dressing for success type approach, because this world has really changed over the last 20 years in terms of the more formal to casual look. But I still feel a little old school where it's like nice in a situation wherever I'm going up and doing a presentation or I'm at a conference or something like that, it's nice to put something a little bit more formal on. And I feel more confident, you know, throwing that suit jacket on, maybe throwing a tie on. Like, I don't know, something about that makes me push my shoulders back and feel a little bit more proud and give me some of that internal confidence. So I definitely think it's something to look into if you're somebody that's usually pretty casual and maybe you have an opportunity to dress up a little bit in a moment that you might be more in the spotlight.
Justin, I agree 100% with that. There has been a paradigm shift with the dressing, but you can still have informal, formal, you know, as a hybrid together, but it's still nice. Go out and buy that nice new suit or whoever, you know, get that nice suit, the nice tie, nice pair of shoes, and look your best. And you know, like I like 3-piece suits. I like it. And if I'm doing a presentation, which I love to public speak, a lot of times I'll go buy a new suit and have it tailored absolutely perfect. Not how much you pay for the suit. It's how it's tailored. It tells you how nice, it makes a suit look beautiful. It still, at my age, gives me great confidence to have that beautiful suit, know I'm the best dressed in the room. That will give me confidence, even as they say, at my age, knowing I'm the best dressed in that room, just you want to be up and speak, you want to present. Gives you that extra edge, I think.
Yeah, even just like going to get a haircut the day before or something, you know, if you're going to get up and speak or do a presentation or something, and it's like, man, I look good today.
Absolutely. That I get a haircut every week. So I
really?
Get it. Yes. Goodness sakes.
So your barber knows you by first name and has the drink ready for you when you show up and everything.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I've been going to him since 1990, so he does know me well.
Whoa.
I was very young in 1990, just so everyone knows. I was really, really young. I was 5 years old, I think.
Man, that's someone that gets a wedding invitation at that point.
I was at his wedding, actually.
Wow, that's cool. That's cool. Well, Dave, let's wrap things up here. I got one more for you, which may be the one that you're almost the most passionate about. And it comes across really authentically. The first time we met, throughout reading your book, and now getting to interact with you again today, which is number 6, to care about people and to look out for their best interest. And of course, I want to share a little bit about how you do that at the dealership, but maybe you can talk about a story that I feel like someone reciprocated that same kind of sentiment to you, which seemed to be your realtor. You talked about this in the book and how your realtor took care of you. Do you mind sharing that story?
No, I'd love to. Commercial realtor I've been working with for all of a decade. And I'm one of those people that when it comes to business or buying, I'll shoot and clean up later. And I like buying real estate, commercial houses, condos. And he always takes Dave Lamont's best interest into it. I'll say, let's write it up. Let's make an offer. Let's get things rolling here. He's like, Dave, slow down. It's not the right piece of property for you. And think what his odds go up so much more for the next deal because he's established. He's like, I do this deal with you. You may never do another deal with me. In 3 months, it turns out to be a bad deal. So I have a lot of respect for him saying, no, let's find you the right deal. And then if this is the right deal, we'll get you the next right deal. You know, it's a long road. Let's do the right things. And so I have a lot of respect for him. Not back to my saying, he's not looking for a quick dime. He's looking for the slow quarter. He's doing the right thing for Dave Lamont. And him taking the time, he's patient. We'll look at the right things. I think it's so important caring about people doing the right thing. You know, and I do state it on some sort of the same topic. I see people that they'll do you a favor, but they want something in return. Is that really a servant or helping someone? No. If I do someone a favor, help them out, I don't need anything in return because I care about them. I'm doing it because I care. I want them to do better in life. But I see so many people that's push-pull. You know, I'll do this for you. I need that. For the listeners, remember, help someone out for nothing in return because ironically, someone will do something for you with nothing in return. And it's all reciprocal, I believe. So caring, I think, is so important. And people will learn fast if you genuinely care and you're doing the right thing for them. And people certainly will do the right things for you. Like I stated, I want everyone around me successful because if they are, what am I? I'm successful. It's a very easy concept. You want your friends to do well, your family to do well, and lo and behold, you'll do well. But caring is such an important thing, and that's why I put the story of the realtor in there. He always does the right thing. And he's being noted on this podcast because he does the right thing.
Yeah, and it's interesting looking at your business model too, because I'll be honest, I think car dealerships get a bad rep and car salesmen get a bad rep. You know, the quick dime, I think a lot of people have probably experienced that as someone that's dealt with a salesperson selling them a car, knowing there's tons of dealerships around, they try to get them in the car and they try to get that car sold. But I love that you take a different approach with your dealership and you are thinking long term. You're not thinking when a new customer walks onto your lot, I'm going to sell them a car today. You're thinking, I want to sell them cars for the rest of their life. And you're thinking about, you know, what's got to make the most sense for them in the long term. Do I have that right? Is that kind of your mentality with your customers?
You know, you're right, Justin. At Renfrew Chrysler in Calgary, you know, I don't want to see them. I don't want the salespeople to sell them a car. I want them to help buy a car. Do the right thing, because if we help them buy a car, show them all the details, give them a great deal, show them how the deal's put together, not only will continue to buy from Renfrew Chrysler, they will tell their friends and family. We get referrals from it. And it costs so much money to find a new lead than just to keep a customer and retain that customer. So I think it's instilled that we want to do the right things with these customers. And someone just wants to be shown the deal, how it's put together, and they want a fair deal, an excellent deal, and, you know, no quick dime, no, they just want to be treated well. That's why the sales staff here at Renfrew have been here so long, because they like to do the right things. And customers just want to be treated fairly. And the amount of referral business we get because of that is astronomical.
Yeah, I think, although I wrote down many of quotes from your book, my favorite quote.
My Lamontisms? That
yes. My favorite quote that I wrote down here, which I feel like really just summarizes this skill a whole lot, is when you said, shoot to win 80% of the time in life. That's more than enough. People who have to win 100% of the time cut corners and steamroll over others. I'd rather make $1 the right way than $1.10 the wrong way.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
Which is just so good. Like, I think that's so right. It's something that, you know, as a business owner as well, I really try to embody, just because it's just, you don't want to make money the wrong way. I remember in January, we had a customer that was launching a podcast, and he prepaid for a couple of episodes, and then throughout his launch realized that actually he didn't have the time to make for podcasting. And he was like, hey guys, I know I already prepaid for these episodes. You can totally make the money. You can totally keep the money. That makes sense from a cash flow standpoint. And I'm kind of pulling the rug out from you guys. And I kind of just flat out told him, like, yeah, I want to make the money that I earn. Like, I really want to earn that money there. And if we didn't produce those episodes for you, then I'm not really that excited to take your money. So we refunded him. And it was so cool, because 1 month later, he came back to me and he was like, hey, I got a video project that I need some help with. Is your team capable of doing that? And he paid for a video package. So even though I knew I was letting go of a customer and I thought we were never going to see him again, it was kind of crazy that he came back not a year later, but a month later, knowing how that relationship ended and still wanting to support us. And I think that just shows if you take care of people, the world and other people will take care of you too.
You're Justin, absolutely correct. You did the right thing and it worked in your favor. Worked for everyone. It was a win-win.
Well, Dave, as we're concluding this conversation, you know, I did really want to talk about these six skills to kind of bulletproof your career. And a lot of this is in the lens of, you know, having a successful career, therefore, you know, increasing your earning capital and making money. But we know it's not all about the money. And you opened up the book with this parable around the 2 million yacht versus the 80K Mastercraft. I'd love to close with this and just kind of reinforce the fact that although we are trying to make money, that doesn't necessarily need to be the end all with all of this. You know, thinking back to the sixth skill there, which is caring about other people and looking out for their best interest and shooting to win 80% of the time, I think there's so much of the pie to go around. And if you're doing all the right things, you're going to get taken care of. But do you mind sharing that parable that you opened up with around the yacht and the Mastercraft?
No, absolutely. And, you know, I would say if you do all the right things and you're successful, money will follow you. But success and money, they interchange, but they're not stackable. And that person with the, and, you know, a true story, you know, that person with the a beautiful Mastercraft's a great boat, but much different than a $2 million yacht. But who really is successful? The person that has the lineup of 10 people to get on that boat, that person has success. He has friends. He has people around him. He gets to enjoy these people. The person on the yacht with no one, is that really success? I don't see. That's why they don't overlap. You know, money will follow success. But, you know, I want to finish with that. Remember, if you do all the right things, the money will follow. Don't worry about the money. It will come. By doing all the right things, wanting to do well in life, being successful, helping your friends, people around you be successful. But I wanted to lead in with that boat story because it gives you an idea of Dave Lamont, the book itself. And if someone really deep dives into that comment, it's like, okay, I see that picture now. Success is the people around you. If I'm alone on a $2 million yacht, I'm not having a lot of fun. I'll be honest with you, Justin. I'm not having a lot of fun, but I'm lined up to get on that Mastercraft and I get on there. That's success. There's 12 of us having a lot of fun on a boat, a lot of laughs and a lot of stories and a lot of memories.
Well, Dave, it's been a pleasure. I'll have one more final question for you, but if people want to check out the book, once again, that's Crank It. The subtitle is A Playbook for Succeeding in Business and Life. If you're on video right now, Dave's got the cover art up on screen right now. It was a really fun read. I think an inspirational read too, and a good mix between some fun stories and inspiring stories and some good actual tactical information too. And you laid out the book in a really easy and concise way to follow. So I'm guessing people can find that anywhere they find books.
Yeah, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Chapters, Indigo.
Yeah. Awesome. Dave, my final question for you. If you had the opportunity to teach a 16-week class to a group of graduating college seniors on a topic that isn't normally covered in the classroom, what would you teach and how would you teach it?
I would probably teach, you know, not in the classroom because, you know, organizational skills are public speaking, finance. I would speak about passion because passion's such an important thing. Like you can see, business to me is absolute passion. I love it. And passion is something you're doing when you're not getting paid for. So I would like a 16-week course of how to find passion and what passion is. And when I'm working on a Sunday, per se, on my kitchen table making notes, that's passion for what I do in business. It doesn't mean I'm getting paid sitting at that table working on notes. I would teach a 16-week course on passion. And not only would it be, it would just be life skills about passion. And once you find a passion, Justin, it's not work anymore. I don't come to work because I have to. It's because I want to. I love it. I love business. I love the car business. I love real estate. I enjoy it.
Very well said. I'd love to take that class too, especially from a very passionate teacher like yourself. I think I would just kind of follow behind in your footsteps. So once again, this is Dave Lamont, author of Crank It. Go check it out anywhere you can find books. Dave, it's been such a pleasure. Thanks so much for spending so much time with me.
Justin, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I'm honored to be on it.
Thanks for listening to the episode. As always, I appreciate your kind words. If you want to leave us a rating and review on your podcast player right now, that would absolutely make my day. If you want to find episode show notes, our blog, and other great resources, head over to tsirpodcast.com. If you have follow-up questions, an idea for a future episode, or just want to say hi, we have a contact form on our website, and those messages go straight into my inbox, and I promise you, I will reply. But all right, guys, I really appreciate you tuning in. I love you all, and you're not alone. Let's keep making it through our struggles together. We'll be right back.